Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host, and we got a great show for you today. A great show from the newly redesigned studio here in El Cajon, California. Second hour, Mark Brumley will be here with us, and we'll do open forum. You can ask Mark anything you want. This hour, we're going to talk about end-of-life issues, something we probably should talk about a bit more, in part because we all need to consider these things, but also in part because as a society, we need to be considering these things. We're making some bad choices, frankly, and so we'll talk about all of that. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884, whether you have a more society-wide question or a specific question about end-of-life planning and end-of-life policy and all of that. 888-318-7884. Our guest this hour is attorney Jason Negri, who serves as assistant director of the Patients' Rights Council. That's in Steubenville, Ohio. The Patients' Rights Council is committed to the principle that you have the right to know all the facts about the critical issues of life, death, and assisted suicide. Offers understanding and practical support for those facing those critical situations, either themselves or a loved one, and provides kind of what we might call a rational public view and factual information about suicide, euthanasia, all the end-of-life things. As I said, attorney Jason Negri,
yes.
That's also related here because you are an estate attorney.
Yes, that's true. In Michigan only, but yeah, I'm an estate planning attorney.
Well, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Does it look bleak out there, the way society is going as far as end-of-life issues?
It looks about as bleak as it has looked for the past 15 years, to be honest.
Yeah.
The forces who are in favor of legalizing doctor-prescribed suicide, they really have done a full court press for the past 20-somewhat years in trying to make it legal. And they try in about 20 to 25 states every single year. Sometimes they persuade a state, whether it's the legislature or a public referendum. Sometimes they win. Often they lose. They've got about 9 or so states right now.
But they never quit.
They just
come back again and again and again.
They never
do. They do have the benefit of a very simple argument. If I wanna, I should be allowed to.
Which, unfortunately, is particularly appealing in modern America.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
It all has to do with autonomy and your rights and everything about you.
And so you're left with the Patients' Rights Council and with all the work that you do educating the public on this, with a lot of explaining to do, in other words, about why this is bad public policy and not just bad public policy, but is bad for the person who's put in the position of having to choose about euthanasia and suicide.
It is. That's true. And you're right when you articulate it that way, too, because our position is not it's not as much of a soundbite, if you will, as
right.
The other side is.
Yeah.
You know, it does require somewhat more explanation and digging into why our position is actually the more compassionate one, which is, you know, the other side tries to claim all this high ground about being the compassionate solution for people who are suffering. But when you really dig down to the facts that are at stake and the issues that they're bringing up, it's not as easily understood. But these things have to be taken on head on.
888-318-7884 is our number. Jason Negri, our guest from the Patients' Rights Council. If you have questions about end-of-life issues, perfect hour for you. 888-318-7884. Anyone can call. You don't have to agree with us. You don't have to be a Christian, a Catholic. You just call if you got a question or you want to engage in some conversation about it. 888-318-7884. It just seems to me that I expect, unless something catastrophic happens, that as I approach my death, I will become increasingly vulnerable. And so if there's actual pressure about how expensive my death is, you know, or my care, end-of-life care is, if you want to put it a nice way, and all that, that there might be those who would exert pressure to find an easy exit.
That pressure is very real, and it's something that most people don't think much about until they get to that point in their own lives, or if they've got a loved one who's approaching, you know, the twilight years themselves. The pressure is real to just, you know, quietly get out of the way. In my own practice, meeting with clients who come in, they talk about doing their will and their powers of attorney, and in the context of those conversations, of course, we do talk about the medical power of attorney, end-of-life medical care, what sort of care they do and don't want, and a fair number of them, they may not actually use the phrase, but their attitude is, I don't want to be a burden.
Yeah, right.
And it's a commonly understood idea. It's a great concept in rugged autonomous America, where we've, you know, since 1787, we've been making our own way as individuals.
Yeah.
And if you can't be a, quote, productive member of society, there's definitely a corollary to that, that that you don't belong here, or you are much more expendable and ought to just get out of the way. It's a very hard concept, particularly for Americans, to get away from. But that idea of being a burden, it's hard to fight against, but it's sinister.
It's that rugged individualism that we're that we applaud ourselves for, but it has its limits because,
right.
You know, I imagine we can talk too about folks who have disabilities and the pressure that they face.
Absolutely.
But the truth is, as a friend of mine who had disabilities said, almost everybody has disabilities at some time.
In some regard, at some point, yes,
yeah.
We do.
Right. So we all are part of the disabled community at some time.
Right. But many of us don't, to use a common term, we don't identify as such nowadays.
Right.
But if you have friends who have disabilities or people who are involved in the disability rights community, they are very, very well aware of this pressure. The proponents of doctor-assisted suicide, generally speaking, are the white, worried, wealthy, and well, right?
Oh.
They don't know what it's like to not have the medical care that they want. To them, it is something to be chosen or to just be rejected if
right.
they're sick of life, so to speak.
Right.
But you talk to anybody in the minority communities or the disability rights community, they know firsthand what it's like to be marginalized and to not get the care that they want and need. They're scared to death of this, and rightly so. The more this mentality takes hold in society, the harder it is for people who want and desperately want that care and that inclusion. It's going to be harder for them to get it because the expectation for everybody is going to increasingly be just take your pills, get out of the way.
Well, it's really striking to hear you say white because we know from it's an absolute fact that African American children are victims of abortion at a much higher rate, and that those who want to engage in abortion position themselves to be ready to take black lives. I hadn't thought about that, but the same mentality could easily apply to the end of life as well if we don't want to pay for care.
Yeah, I suppose it does. We in our work, we tend not to really focus on the issues of abortion as much at all because there's a lot of other good groups and people doing
who do that.
Nobody really is doing what we're doing in terms of the specific and select focus on the end of life issues on a national perspective and keeping tabs on the changing laws in the states, the publishing and
right.
the speaking that we do. So I'm not gainsaying, you know, what you're saying. It's true. But people in those communities will tell you firsthand how hard it is to
right.
get their concerns listened to. It's become common parlance right now to talk about what do they call it, white privilege.
Yeah.
Well, this is a concrete example of white privilege.
All these choices at the end of life.
Yes, exactly.
Right, just like you had throughout life.
Right.
888-318-7884, 888-318-7884, our number. Attorney Jason Negri is our guest from the Patients' Rights Council. What else should we know about what's going on right now as far as end-of-life issues?
Well, just as you mentioned before, they're the other side, if you will. They've been aggressively promoting their position and trying to expand what they call end-of-life choices,
mm-hmm.
you know, under this innocuous sounding term, whether they call it self-deliverance or aid in dying or something, it plays right into that American mentality
yeah.
of self. So one of the important things to realize is almost always when they're talking about this and trying to get an initiative passed in a particular state, they will very often make reference to the state of Oregon, which was the first state
yes.
to legalize right. doctor-prescribed suicide way back when. And there are annual reports by the Health Department of Oregon regarding people who take advantage of this and who request these lethal doses of medication to end their lives. Many, many times when their spokespeople come up and talk about this, they'll point to Oregon and say, there have been no problems there. The statistics in Oregon suggest that there are no problems and this can be done safely. Well, first of all, what you're talking about itself is
not very safe.
It's not very
suicide,
safe.
Suicide, yeah.
Right, but even if you're not going to talk about that point, it really would help people to understand that the example of Oregon is not a good one because those statistics, such as they are all self-reported. There's no enforcement mechanism in Oregon regarding their end-of-life act. There needs to be a request made to the doctor, two oral requests and a written request. But when the prescription is finally written and given to the patient, nobody is required to be present when they actually take it. And that's really where the rubber hits the road, is when and if they get to that point where they're feeling very low, that might be when somebody would take the prescription. But the fact is they've got it and nobody is going to be there to see what happens. Are there bad side effects? Well, we know when people take a drug in this amount, in this dosage that's required to kill them, the side effects are well known. You're talking about, you know, burning of the mouth and throat, vomiting, nausea, seizures, things of that sort.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to report it because a doctor is not required to be there. And when a doctor is present and does report it, that doctor is already compromised. We know which side they're on.
Right, because they're already
They have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo of legalization because that's where they are.
Yeah.
And if they start reporting all of these negative side effects and things that happen, well, we know there's going to be some questions asked that are uncomfortable.
Right.
It's kind of like when, you know, various states are experiencing budget deficits and they decide that, well, we're going to save a little bit of money and we're not going to have the highway patrol enforce speeding anymore.
Yeah.
Instead, when you get to your destination after traveling on Highway 5, why don't you just give us a call?
Self-report.
Right. Call in this 1-800 number. Yeah. Let us know if you were speeding,
right.
if you imbibed any adult beverages, if you were texting while you were driving, and we'll assign the proper fine. Who do you think is going to call in a situation like that?
Right.
It's analogous to the situation in Oregon.
Sure.
Nobody's going to call and talk about the problems they experienced.
Right. Maybe we could get bank robbers to report bank robbers.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. Yeah. 888-318-7884, our number. Jason Negri is our guest. We're talking about end-of-life issues. We'd love to have a conversation with you if you'd like conversation or if you have questions, Jason is the exact guy to ask those questions. So you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Take a quick break. Be right back with calls for Jason Negri on end of life issues.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with program info, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. Just go to EWTN.com/wings. Fill out your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. When you get yours, send it to all your friends, and they can send it to their friends. And pretty soon, we're covering the whole world with the good news about EWTN. Wings, the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jason Negri, our guest. Our number, 888-318-7884, and we're talking about end-of-life issues. Before we go to the phones, if you got somebody in your life that needs an introduction to Jesus, maybe they never got an introduction to Jesus, or maybe it missed them when it came. That's what my new book is for, A Teacher of Strange Things, Who Jesus Was, What He Taught, and Why People Still Follow Him, meant to be a book that you can put in another person's hand and start that conversation about the person of Jesus. You can get it on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. As a matter of fact, 25% off at shop.catholic.com. You just put in the promo code TEACHME and you get that 25% off. And big news, it's in digital format today. I saw it on both Amazon and our own website. So if you go, for example, you want the digital copy, you can get it at 25% off. Or you can get the print copy at 25% off at shop.catholic.com. Either way, use the promo code TEACHME and get your savings. 888-318-7884, our number. We're talking end-of-life issues with Jason Negri. Jason, shall we go to the phones?
Sure, sounds good.
All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Chris in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio, KATH 910 AM. Chris, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jason Negri.
Thank you, gentlemen. This is actually a situation that happened to me about 9 years ago, and I'm kind of looking for a little moral direction in this. My father had a heart attack and ended up in the hospital, developed sepsis, and he eventually passed away from this. And under the circumstances, we had to make the decision of whether or not to continue with the respirator and all the other machinery that was involved. And my mother was unable to make a decision in the matter when the doctors told us that there was nothing more they could do. Okay. And it's something that's bothered me ever since. And I don't know. I wasn't Catholic at the time. I have entered the church since then. And it's one of those things that's always bugged me. I'm like, okay, is this something that it should weigh on me beyond the simple, this is a regrettable situation, or is it one of those circumstances where no, it was still a reasonably moral choice to disconnect the machine?
Okay. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, that's a great question. People ask it in the abstract quite often. You having actually gone through it would obviously be concerned about this. really what you have to look at, and I can't know the specific details other than what you shared, you know, in your question. There are principles here regarding removing what might be deemed burdensome medical care, right? And there actually is a moral calculus that the bishops give to us that is consistent with church teaching in this area, where you have to assess the burden of the treatment and how that stacks up against the expected benefit to the patient. And you can apply this to any type of situation. In the situation you're talking about, if the person is, in fact, in a vegetative state and doesn't have any reasonable hope of recovery at all, which it sounds like that was the case with your dad, that's a medical opinion, not an ethical one. But based upon the medical factors, if that is the case, and if a machine is, in fact, doing his breathing for him, he has lost the ability to breathe on his own, right? So that biological function is not applicable, and a machine is artificially doing his breathing for him and literally keeping him alive, then, again, based on what you have told me, it does seem like it is a moral decision to be able to remove that respirator and allow the person to pass away naturally. It's not affirmatively causing their death the way, for example, removing food and water would be, because that's a normative type of treatment, not a medical one. But if the body has lost the ability to breathe and a machine is artificially doing that, then yes, it is considered morally legitimate in most cases to remove that respirator and allow death to take place naturally.
Does that help you, Chris?
It does. It actually helps me quite a bit. It's been, you know, almost a decade. It's been bugging me, and I really appreciate your answer. It was very helpful and very clear.
Sure.
Thank you, Chris. I'm glad Chris started us with that question. I'm very grateful for the question, Chris, but because many Catholics that I have met, some quite well-educated, think that the Catholic Church teaches that you have to do everything to keep a person alive. They mean that sincerely.
I've encountered that a few times.
And that is not at all what the Church teaches.
No, it's not.
Yeah, so you got, and then people end up, even a priest might tell them, it's time to let go, and the priest is acting in good faith, but they won't believe it because they believe that the Church's teaching is never let go. Just fight for right. Every breath.
Right, yeah, and that's a misnomer, and I think in some cases it does heap up unnecessary burdens and put them on people
right.
That don't need to be there. It's unfortunate, but that is a misconception.
888-318-7884, our number. We're talking about end-of-life issues with Jason Negri, who is himself an attorney who deals with end-of-life issues in the state of Michigan and the assistant director of the Patients' Rights Council. I got it right, yes?
You did.
Okay, good. Let's go to Shania in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic
Go Huskers.
Radio. Shania, all right, you got your Go Huskers in there. Are you there with us, Shania?
Yep.
All right, go ahead.
My question is how do people think that morally, if you can tell that someone is spiritually aware of everything around them, or if you hold, I guess, I don't know. It's, I'm trying to put this into words.
Okay, let me just ask you this, Shania. Is the question related to suicide and euthanasia?
And
so you're saying some
legalizing it,
right?
Okay, so how can, for example, someone, if someone else is in their right mind and they choose that, how can we say no, they should not be allowed to do that? That's where I'm getting we're going, Shania, but I'm not sure.
No, I'm just my question is more so how. How does our government think that, or how do people think that even if someone's in their right mind, that they would be able
To choose suicide?
To actually do that.
Or, yeah.
Right. And this obviously is something that's very close to you, Shania. Hang on. I'm going to come back to you, but let's let Jason take a shot at an answer. To the question of why folks think that a government should allow people to choose suicide.
Well, there's actually a fundamental difference between the way state laws treat suicide itself mm-hmm. versus assisting a suicide.
Okay.
And it does go to the mental state of the patient, of the person involved. There are actually no state laws prohibiting suicide itself.
Well, they're not.
Out of recognition of the fact that the people who choose this are in some side of, you know, in some sort of extreme state of mind where they're feeling desperate.
Oh, okay.
And despairing. And we don't want to create, you know, an additional burden on them if, God forbid, they were to try to commit suicide and fail.
Then try them for an attempted
and
murder.
And then try them for attempted suicide,
which
is always a corollary to the state. So those those laws, there used to be laws on the books prohibiting suicide, and we realized that it was kind of counterproductive. It didn't really help the people the way
that's
it was
supposed
to.
That's not what people need.
But that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about assisting a suicide. You've got an objective third party whose judgment supposedly is clear, trying to help somebody in this act of desperation.
Yeah.
And that's what is on the books as criminal in every state. Even though a few states have since legalized doctor-assisted suicide, they make an exception if it's a doctor and meets certain criteria. But it still fundamentally is, you're talking about somebody who is assisting somebody else to kill themselves. And that's what's generally speaking prohibited.
Shania, are you? What do you think? You all right?
I think, yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
I think how could you, you can't really undo what's already been done, obviously. So if someone had carried out with it and it was done, there would be nothing more that you can do. But I guess, in my personal opinion, helping is not to assist somebody carrying out suicide. Helping someone, I guess, would be helping someone that's a suicidal to kind of lead them into a different direction, that there's more ways out.
Right.
You have more options to be alive than you do to be dead.
Oh, exactly. That's so beautifully said, Shania.
Which is why there are suicide hotlines, and we rightly look upon it as a crisis situation that people should be intervening and helping with. Helping somebody commit suicide is not the answer. It's such a cognitive dissonance with the way we treat suicide in general to try to think that assisted suicide is somehow this benighted, compassionate option when you look at how we ought to be treating people who are suicidal to begin with.
And Shania, thank you so much for your question and for taking the time. I really appreciate your call. It seems to me that a society-wide message that we want you to live, you know, to people who are suffering suicidal thoughts, suicidal depressions and whatnot, is compromised, like if we speak out of the other side of our mouth with somebody else in another situation. We don't really oppose suicide anymore. We're not against it anymore.
Right. I mean, we recognize it for what it is. It's not an action to be condemned. It's a plea for help for somebody who needs assistance.
Okay. Shania, thanks very much for your call. Our number is 888-318-7884. What about doctors? Do you have any concern as a practical matter if suicide, for example, becomes commonplace, assisted suicide, I mean, physician-assisted suicide. I mean, we always had heard, and I realize you're not an abortion advocate, but this is just as a parallel. For years and years, we had heard, well, if you don't want an abortion, don't choose one. But now we see Catholic hospitals being attacked and they're being told that they could lose their funding if they don't provide abortions and all that. So obviously, if you don't want one, don't get one isn't real.
No.
And so when people say, well, if you don't want to participate in suicide, don't. But what will happen to doctors? Will they face governmental pressure to participate in this?
Unfortunately, they very likely will. If you look just north to us, to Canada, they had a sweeping nationwide law legalizing both assisted suicide and euthanasia back in, I think it was 2015, 2016. Immediately, you saw some Canadian periodicals, news articles, magazines calling for doctors to be required to participate in their patients' suicides because they looked upon assisted suicide and euthanasia as a right.
Yeah.
And as soon as something is deemed a right, you cannot deny it to them. So, and within 2 years, it wasn't just newspapers calling for it. It was actually the Supreme Court of Canada determined that doctors do not have the right to not participate. If they're not going to do it themselves, they must make a referral to a colleague who will. And to some doctors, that constitutes participation in the act. They want nothing to do with it.
Right.
It can't be that way in Canada anymore. And it's coming to America in a slightly different format. It's already the case for other healthcare practitioners.
Yeah, like a pharmacist, for example.
Exactly. That is exactly the example. Doctors, for now, in Oregon, have a safe harbor provision, and they have a conscience clause, and they don't have to participate. Pharmacists do not have that right. If you're a pharmacist and a doctor writes a prescription for a lethal overdose, you have to fulfill it.
And that's horrifying.
I mean, it is.
You can't do your job then. I mean, but basically they're saying to certain people of conscience, this is not a job for you because you're going to have to say no, and then you're out of a job.
Yep. And it's marginalizing people of conscience and people of religious sensibilities who don't want to be participating in this.
Right.
But that's the wave of it. What starts as an option for some people, which is exactly how they get it in the door, will rapidly become an expectation for everyone, for both the medically vulnerable who are going to be swept along in this,
right,
and for the doctors who don't want to but might be forced to participate.
We got lots of folks on the line. Hang on the line, folks. We're going to get to your calls when we come back. Attorney Jason Negri, an end-of-life attorney in the state of Michigan and the assistant director of the Patients' Rights Council, is here with us to take your calls. 888-318-7884.
Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, decluttering.
Is your life cluttered up with problems you're tired of dealing with? We're going to help you clean house.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Second hour, Mark Brumley will be here, and we're going to do open forum. Any question you got, welcome during open forum. This hour, Jason Negri is with us, and he emphasizes to me, not a theologian, not someone to speak on behalf of the church, but rather an attorney, a Catholic, end-of-life attorney, familiar with these topics, and also very able to speak on behalf of the Patients' Rights Council, where he is
associate director.
I knew that. I knew it was associate director. Back to the phones then. We'll go. Bethany in Binghamton, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. Glad to have you with us, Bethany. Go ahead with your question for Jason Negri.
Hi. So I'm a speech language pathologist and I work in a nursing home and I deal with a lot of people who have swallowing impairments. So sometimes I have to make a really hard decision about whether it's safe or not for someone to consume food orally. And my question is it considered morally wrong if I'm making a decision where someone really, I'm recommending that they cannot have something orally, and usually in these cases it leads, obviously it leads to their body weakening further at the end of their lives. And that's just my question. Is it morally wrong for me to be making that decision?
Well, your question is partially, I think, a moral one. Partially, it's a medical judgment. The criteria that you're speaking about by which you have to make this decision seems sound to me, that you have to make a determination if somebody's risk of choking or aspiration outweighs their ability to continue to consume food orally. And we both know that there are alternative means of introducing food and nutrition to the body. There's different types of tubes, J-tube, G-tube, those are primary examples of that. So based upon what you're telling me, no, I don't think it's immoral for you to make that determination that they shouldn't eat by mouth anymore. Just, however, being aware that in doing so, they are very likely going to be relying on tube feeding, which in far too many circles is deemed to be what we talked about earlier. Too many places deem tube feeding to be extraordinary medical treatment, which could be removed if the patient isn't, quote, getting any better. That is the moral problem that I have with the situation, not with your initial determination that a patient probably shouldn't be eating by mouth anymore because there's a heightened risk of choking, but rather realizing that the alternative is for them to be receiving nutrition and hydration by way of a tube. And that very factor, unfortunately, makes a lot of people think that it is automatically artificial medical treatment, which can therefore be removed. And that's not the case.
Bethany, what do you think?
Yeah, no, that's great. I definitely do have a lot of conversations about PEG tubes and J tubes and things like that. And I didn't really think of it on that side of things. So I appreciate you giving me that answer.
Yeah, thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Bethany. Thanks very much. We'll go now to Robert in Texas, listening on EWTN channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Robert, thanks so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jason Negri.
Hey, everybody. First off, God bless all of your listeners. They seem to be carrying their cross as well. I'm also an attorney in Texas. And what I was going to say is I don't know if Jason's a member of the Catholic Lawyers Guild. But it's always good if we can band together as learned counsel to fight against this fight. I'm in a different area of law, but thanks to him, I might be looking at a career change.
Yeah,
the other thing I was going to say is that there are what we call here in Texas. I can't speak outside of Texas, but at least here in Texas, we have what's called directed to physicians, and they also call them living wills that are specifically written to conform with the doctrine of the Catholic Church. So they're written and they're I don't know if is that your right counsel? Your name is Jason, I think.
Well, they call them different things in different states, but the concept of a living will is kind of the generic term. I'm familiar with living wills as such.
Well, what about
cool, the, awesome. Well, what I mean, I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go
I just,
ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to follow up with the question on the, what'd you call it? The Catholic Lawyers Guild?
Yes.
Catholic Lawyers Guild, yeah.
Okay.
It's an organization of Catholic attorneys, and it's there are chapters here and there and everywhere, and some of them are very active, some of them are not. But any attorneys out there that might be listening, try to find it. And if you can't find it, start one, you know, because it's very important that we can use our talents for the grace of God and try to band together and try to, be a voice for the kingdom.
Right. Well, Robert, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate your call. And for that, you'd agree the Catholic Lawyers Guild is good. He's not like making me advertise something that's...
No, they're sound.
Okay. Oh, man. I don't know, because I don't know the Catholic Lawyers Guild.
No, you're safe. They're a good group.
Okay, right. I don't know what they do at their meetings. Robert, thank you very, very much. We're talking about end-of-life issues. Attorney Jason Negri here with us, the Associate Director of the Patients' Rights Council. You can find them online. Just type in Patients' Rights Council, and you can find their materials online. Mm-hmm. And if you'd like to talk with Jason Negri, give us a call, 888-318-7884. Going to Ohio now. Mary in Canton, Ohio. Listening on Living Bread Radio. You are next, Mary. Thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jason Negri.
Yes, good evening. My question pertains to the advanced medical directives from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. I was questioning if you needed to have another document, such as I'm here in Ohio. Is it important to have the Ohio Living Will, or will the bioethics advanced medical directive stand? I was told that it wouldn't stand if you were in hospice or if you're in the ER or, intensive care. And I thought that the person who told me this was rather knowledgeable. So I was just delighted that I could voice that to you.
Well, Mary, let me just ask you this before we get an answer from Jason. But do you want this? You want either the directive or a living will, because you want to make sure that the treatment that you receive at the end of your life is consistent with what the church teaches about the end of life?
Exactly. Now,
okay.
I already have the NCBC form.
Okay.
And they were saying that that was not going to stand up in the hospital, et cetera.
Okay.
I needed to have something that was the Ohio legal living will or advanced medical directive.
All right. Well, let's hear from the lawyer.
Yeah. Thanks for your question, Mary. Actually, I'm going to recommend a better option for you. First of all, I would say do not get a living will. Living wills are fraught with danger because even though you think you're writing down what you want, the person who's going to be interpreting the language of that living will may or may not be on the same page with you philosophically, morally, spiritually, and they might decide to interpret it a little bit differently than you want it to be interpreted. The previous caller's questioning regarding swallowing and tube feeding is a perfect example. You might say something along the lines of, I don't want any extraordinary medical treatment to sustain my life. But a well-meaning but erroneous doctor or nurse could look at that and say, well, that includes tube feeding, so we're just going to remove tube feeding because that's extraneous and extraordinary treatment. So I would say do not do a living will. I can't speak to the contents of the NCBC's document. There are many good organizations out there that have their own documents. I don't know whether they specify it according to each state's laws, and that might be the shortcoming that somebody's talking about. But I will recommend that you look into our document. The Patients' Rights Council has an advance directive, which is a durable power of attorney for healthcare, and it identifies a trusted decision maker who can make those decisions for you in the event you become unable to make those decisions for yourself. And I know that our document, we do actually do the research and make sure that we have one that complies with the laws in every single state. And the Patients' Rights Council, of course, is based in Ohio, so you know that that one's going to be good. But yes, I strongly recommend you contact the Patients' Rights Council and ask for what we call our PMDD, our Protective Medical Decisions document, and ask for the one from Ohio.
Does that help you, Mary?
Oh, that's outstanding. Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Sure. My pleasure.
Thank you. Kind of nice talking to Mary.
Yeah.
I hope she calls back sometime. I should have asked her what her favorite topics are. We could plan more shows like that, and then Mary will call back. We got to take a quick break, right back with more with Jason Negri on end-of-life issues.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
He was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and our guest is Jason Negri, end-of-life attorney in the state of Michigan and also associate director of the Patients' Rights Council. I said you can go on the internet and find the Patients' Rights Council by just putting in the words Patients' Rights Council, but you all have that old-fashioned thing called a phone number, too.
We do. You can actually reach us on a landline, believe it or not. The number for the Patients' Rights Council is 800-958-5678.
800-958-5678.
5678.
78. I always say it twice. I don't know why.
And of course, online, it's just patientsrightscouncil.org. Pretty simple.
And an actual human being answers that phone?
Yes, believe it or not. Nancy will take your call.
What century is it in Ohio? Caitlin in Rochester, New York, listening on the Station of the Cross. You are next. Thank you for your call. Caitlin, go ahead with your question for Jason Negri.
Hi. So I actually have a Catholic living will. It was actually written and I guess prepared in another state, but I presume it would still be somewhat legally binding in the state of New York. My question is that right now we're in the age of COVID, and I live in a state where it's been particularly restrictive.
Yes, you do.
And it's not always the case that you can have someone come into the hospital with you. So if I were unconscious in a car accident or an emergency, how can I be sure that my hospital or my provider is aware of this document, and how do I make sure that they follow it?
That is a fantastic question. And unfortunately, still being in the age of COVID, questions like this are still being worked out in real time. I would like to say that there is a surefire way that you can make sure that your providers are aware of and follow your advance directive, but there's no real way to be sure, especially if it depends on the nature of the advance directive you have. You're characterizing it as a Catholic living will. Well, if it's a living will, that means that it's not identifying a trusted decision maker. It's actually purporting to put forth in the document itself the care you do or don't want. There's no accountability. There's nobody else looking to make sure that the doctors and nurses are reading it and interpreting it properly. So I would stay away from the living will for that reason alone, and rather get the other type of advance directive, which is what we provide, which is the durable power of attorney for healthcare. It's identifying a person who can assess the totality of the circumstances and make the decision that you want them to make. That's what would be preferable. But again, in the age of COVID, if your decision maker is not permitted to be in the hospital, that's creating problems for the hospital left and right. What about people who don't have living wills, right? They have a family member who, you know, under state law in New York might have to step up and make those decisions. Or if they actually have a power of attorney for healthcare, then that named person is going to have the authority to do that. But if the hospital isn't allowing that person to come in and participate in the conversations, that's a big problem. Unfortunately, I think those are the sorts of problems that are going to be hashed out after the fact by lawsuit.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder, too, if it might be a good idea to somehow make my primary care physician aware of it, hoping that yes, maybe someone would contact them for healthcare information. But
hopefully, if your medical records
like
indicate
said,
who that is. That might be helpful, yeah.
Yeah, that's the only thing I could think of because I had the same thought. It'll be figured out 2 years from now when there's a lot of damage done.
Right.
Yep. Caitlin, I'm going to say thanks.
Thank
Keep
you.
Moving. Lots of folks on the line to ask about end-of-life issues, which makes me think we should do this more often. Thanks very much for the call. Here to help us working through these end-of-life issues in a Catholic way, the Associate Director of the Patients' Rights Council and himself an end-of-life attorney in the state of Michigan, Jason Negri. Up next, Teresa in Florida, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Teresa, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jason Negri.
Well, I'm in Florida, but I have a brother, and I am his DPOA.
Mm-hmm.
Part of my question was answered, but I had to make the decision to give him a feeding tube. But his daughter, my brother made me his DPO, but the daughter is always saying, well, she's next of kin. So I don't know if there's any way like she could take me to court and have that overturned.
That's a great question. My answer to you is that this is America, and unfortunately, people can sue for anything they want, which is problematic and indicative of some of the problems in our society. However, if there were no power of attorney document, then your brother's daughter would probably have priority over you in the statutes to make his decisions for him. But because he has executed a proper durable power of attorney naming you his decision maker, you have priority over her. So she might be able to make trouble for you, but the only way I presume that she would be successful in doing so is if she can persuade the judge that you have somehow been derelict in your duty, you have made an affirmatively bad decision that objectively is bad for him and his care, and I cannot conceivably say that putting him on a feeding tube under normative conditions would qualify for that. So while she might be able to try to make trouble for you, I think your legal standing is probably pretty sound.
very good. Yes, people were very confused that I was the DPOA because would have never. It's everything is the quality of life. You know, they let me just tell you, they didn't. They were against it, but guess what? They gave him that feeding tube. He gained 40 pounds. I paid private for him to have speech. And believe it or not, he started chewing and swallowing on his own.
Fantastic.
And
yeah,
the speech therapist could not believe it because she didn't want to do it.
Teresa, it's a wonderful story. And I'm guessing your brother had some insight into what would happen. And that's why you were made.
Very probably.
The durable power of attorney. Jason Negri is our guest. You're welcome to call with your end of life questions. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Thanks again, Teresa, for the call. I'm going to head to Minnesota now. Eric in Minnesota, also listening to EWTN on Channel 130 on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Eric, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jason Negri.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I was just listening earlier, and I was a little bit unclear on the examples. So the first one I heard was that if someone's on a respirator and no chance of getting better, it would be no issue to remove that and then they would die. But then the later example was the G tube, and that if you remove that, they would die. That would not be okay to do. And I was unclear about the difference, if that makes sense.
Yep, that's actually a very insightful question. The difference has to do with what the patient's body is capable of doing. If you have a patient on a respirator, ostensibly their body has lost the ability to breathe on its own. The respirator is actually carrying out the essential functionality that the body ordinarily should be able to do. Whereas with a G-tube, it's simply introducing the food and water that the body is processing properly. If the body is able to continue to process food and water, then simply providing it by means of a G-tube is not extraordinary. The patient may need a little bit of extra assistance, just like some patients might need help in carrying the food to their mouths. But that's a normative type of situation. And if you've ever had the privilege of being with somebody who's going through the dying process, you would know that the body does start to shut down. The organs no longer work. And once that happens, once the organs are no longer working and the body is no longer properly processing food and water, it's perfectly legitimate to remove food and water at that point. I've actually had discussions and debates with priests who don't understand this, who think that it's morally obligatory to always provide food and water all the way to the bitter end. And that is absolutely not the case. It can be very uncomfortable for the patient, causing actual pain if you're trying to introduce food and water to somebody whose stomach is not digesting anymore.
And then I believe in some cases you can drown them because their lungs will fill with fluid. So, Eric, does that help you? It's the condition of the patient in handling these treatments that is dispositive.
Yeah, I think I get that theory. I can see where it would be sometimes hard to find that line in real life.
Well, Eric, what you just said, I just want to stop there on what you just said. It is, that is why very, very few ethicists or end-of-life experts will give blanket answers all the time, do this or don't do that.
Right.
Because there aren't easy answers in many, many cases. And I know that that produces anxiety in people, but it's something that as mature Catholics, we have to understand. There are very clear, bright line ethical and moral lines that we don't cross, but knowing when we're crossing those lines and when we're not can, in many cases, be difficult, and it takes discernment and often help.
Right. Yeah, the principles are there. How the principles are carried out, given the practicalities of the situation you find yourself in, that could change.
Okay, Eric?
Yep, I hope I never have to do it, but thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Lord does provide help too, and I do think I have to also remember the Lord is kind and merciful. He's not going, well, you got that detail wrong, or that you are obligated to follow basic morals in your treatment of every human being. But if you got something a little bit wrong,
right.
I mean,
he's not standing over you with a stick saying,
you
should have called Jason at 20 o'clock at night to make sure.
Yeah, or you should have given that 20 more minutes. You know, okay, you did the best you could in the situation. So we don't want to put heavy burdens on people, but we do have to be adults about this. And it does require reasoning through things in many cases. It requires reasoning through, and sometimes you need the help of a priest or the National Catholic Bioethics Center or
the
Patients' Rights Council. That's what they're there for. And it's funny because even at the Vatican, you'll notice some medical issues will take years to resolve.
Absolutely.
They'll work and work and work, try and debate and work. So we understand that.
Yeah, these things develop over time. As new medical technologies come down the pipe, we have to deal with what they imply.
Yeah. Jenna in Iowa, listening on 88.1 FM in Iowa. You are next. Go ahead with your question for Jason Negri.
I have a question about the ethics of surgery sometimes. Mm-hmm. I work in cardiac surgery, and occasionally we have very unwell patients who come in for incredibly medically complex procedures. And the surgeons do a whole investigation into what their mortality and morbidity, you know, risk is. And my question is, what are the ethics involved in either choosing to operate and with the knowledge that they're very unlikely to not ever wake up after surgery or have a long, prolonged passing away in an intensive care unit after 6 weeks or 8 weeks,
right,
versus choosing not to operate and telling them, enjoy the rest of your life that you have, letting them go.
Right. Is there such a thing as overtreatment? Is that a thing?
There is absolutely such a thing as overtreatment. And Jenna, what you're describing may in fact be an example of that. I think that conversation, that all-important conversation, needs to happen with the patient and their family members and their primary care physician and the cardiac surgeon who might be carrying out that procedure before the patient makes the decision. I mentioned earlier that there's a moral calculus to be made regarding the benefit-burden ratio, right? Does the proposed treatment carry with it a benefit that is going to outweigh the potential burden on the patient? And unfortunately, making that decision objectively is compromised by our American approach to death. We do not tend to approach death with maturity. It's going to happen to all of us. And if you really sit down and think about it for a little while, it's the silliest thing in the world that we're not spending enough time really considering the very issue that you're bringing up. When they're polled, 83% of Americans in the most recent poll say that given the choice, they would prefer to die at home surrounded by loved ones. But in actuality, fewer than 40% of Americans actually die at home, and far too many of us die in hospitals or nursing homes hooked up to treatments that had dubious value to begin with. But whether it's because of a coercive insurance, you know, companies or a coercive medical establishment, or if doctors are afraid of being sued for not offering every single conceivable treatment, regardless of how little a benefit it might actually offer the patient. There are a multiplicity of reasons why these sorts of situations happen. But you, as somebody who works in cardiac surgery, I don't think you have any moral obligation at that point to engage in or not engage in the surgery. The decision has already been made by the patient, rightly or wrongly.
What do you think, Jenna?
I think that's wonderful. I've talked to the surgeon about this when it happens, and his philosophy is, I'm their only chance. I can't send them off to die without knowing I've tried everything. And sometimes I've said, you know, there's a lot of death dignity in a natural death, and we just struggle with it sometimes, and I just pray to God and know that he's leading me to where I need to be. And while I'm in that operating room, I'm just going to keep on providing the absolute best care I can for that patient.
Exactly. I don't know that I would agree with the surgeon's position. I understand it, but
yeah,
I'm not certain it's a satisfactory answer.
No, it does. Yeah. It seems even a little bit grandiose, and maybe not in a bad way, maybe in a way that is trying to do what's best. But
and I think that's endemic to doctors anyway. I mean, they really do hold a lot of power over life and death in their hands, and maybe they can't get away from that idea that I'm their last chance, and if I don't give this to them,
right,
they're going to die, you know, at home. Well, okay, they're going to die at home, but objectively speaking, that's what most people want anyway.
Yeah. Jenna, thanks. A great, great question to end our hour with Jason Negri on. Thanks very much. Next hour, Mark Brumley will be here, and we'll do open forum. I do want to let you know that next week we have a Focus podcast with our guest today, Jason Negri, on a completely different topic, and I'll invite you to listen to it, because another part of his life is advocacy for victims of sexual abuse. Clergy sexual abuse in particular, and it's called the Daniel
Coalition.
You can look it up. I didn't want to take a chance that I'd get it wrong. The Daniel Coalition, you can look it up. But check out Catholic Answers Focus next week if that is something of interest to you. It's about the laity's interaction with bishops when it comes to these issues, and also how do we advocate for fellow lay folks who have been abused sexually. That'll be on Catholic Answers Focus. Jason Negri, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the hour with you.
Thank you, Si. Me too.
Patients' Rights Council. You can find Jason's work, Patients' Rights Council. Right back.